welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 9th of August 2021, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. We are racing through the year. We're coming into the last month of summer, I guess, and it's the beginning of another week in glorious Blighty, and who better to begin the week with than my co-host Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing? It's been a beautiful weekend on my side of the country. What's it like where you are?
It's been pretty showery, actually. Showery with sunny intervals. So I can't really complain because the rain has been quite heavy on occasions, but it has also tended to be fairly short-lived. So as I always say to people, you should always enjoy the weather, whatever it is, because then you'll always have a good day and the weather will never spoil your day, basically. And so as long as I don't have to go anywhere dressed particularly smartly, then the weather can do what it likes, and I'll always cope.
Yeah, I think we had some of that last week. We had the showers last week and the wind, and now it's sunny again. At least it's still summer, and it's the end of the Olympics at last. I haven't been too impressed with the Olympics. I like to watch my breakfast television, but you were telling me that something interesting about the Olympics and the medals that we win and the sort of sports that we do well at, Max. Do you want to just let the listeners know about that?
Well, I was just mentioning last week, I think, that we tend to do well in our sports that require both a certain amount of power, but also endurance and tactics, but also technology. And so we tend to do well in windsurfing. We tend to do well in cycling, particularly. We tend to do well in sailing and things of that sort. And also the modern pentathlon that involves the athlete interacting, firing a gun, fencing, and riding a horse. And there were some very sort of interesting results and some gold medals won by the British team in that sphere. And I think that over the last perhaps three or so Olympics, we've pretty much positioned ourselves as one of the leaders in the world when it comes to cycling sport. One of the things that I can remember from a fair few years back now, and I can't quite remember when it was, but I remember that Chris Boardman was, who was an athlete at the time, made history by racing and being the first person to race, I believe, on a carbon fiber bike. And there was this, and I can't think again who it was that made the carbon fiber bike, but I remember there was this very sleek looking carbon fiber bike made especially for him. And he did particularly well that year on that bike. And since then, I've noticed that virtually all the teams of all of the competitor nations have now adopted these carbon fiber bikes. And this year, again, our cyclists have done particularly well in the velodrome. And one of the reasons why they've done particularly well is the fact that they've been racing on another revolutionary new bike, which is carbon fibre, as the original one that Chris Boardman had. But these bikes have been made by the Lotus factory, the sports car manufacturer just outside of Norwich. And these bikes, I noticed, have got the forks very set, very, very, very wide apart. And initially I was rather puzzled by this and was trying to think of what reason or what assistance having the fork set that wide apart could have. And then through watching the cycling, I noticed that once you had a head-on shot of a cyclist cycling towards you, you could see that the forks of the bike were aerodynamically shaped in terms of their cross-section, but they were also, the width that they were apart was the same as the rider's legs. And so obviously what these aerodynamic forks are intended to do is to break the wind up so that there is less wind resistance against the cyclist's legs. And you may think, well, cycling, does it have to be that aerodynamic? And the answer is yes, it is. And it was interesting, there was a comment that I heard on television, I think a day or so back, where they were saying about how some of the riders have got cameras on the back of their bikes so that they can, the TV companies can show shots of the riders that are catching them up gradually and passing them. And the commentator pointed out that even the riders that don't have cameras on their bikes, they still have a box that's the same size as the camera mounted on their bike, so that the ones that don't have cameras don't have an aerodynamic advantage over the ones that do have cameras. And so just having a small camera on the rear of your bike, where you would think it actually didn't play any part in the aerodynamics, does make an aerodynamic difference. And so these revolutionary bikes by Lotus appear to have done the job very well, because again, we've had quite a lot of gold medals, and the performances that sort of stick in my mind, I probably will forget some of the riders. In fact, the only two that I can immediately bring to mind are Jason Kenny and Laura Kenny, who've won I think they've won a gold medal each and a silver medal each at this Olympics. I think that Jason Kenny might have won two gold medals at this Olympics, but he's become the most highly decorated British Olympian of all time, I think, because he's got seven gold medals now. And obviously cycled with an outstanding amount of determination and proficiency, etc. I think there's probably no doubt that to some extent the British riders were helped by our superior technology.
So really, it's in sports that involve forward planning and technology and engineering and those sorts of things. And if we're designing things for the sport, then that's something we're going to be really good at, rather than just using brute force, I guess, like the sprint, say. That's just all about running, really, isn't it? And I guess you've got the technology of the running shoes. That when you're talking about cycling, it's going to be the aerodynamics of the cycle, it's going to be the gears. If you're talking about the pentathlon and you're using all these other devices, or if you're taking part in yachting, I guess, you've got a lot of thought that goes into that. You know, I don't often really think about the actual technology side of it in sport, but I guess it's just as important as the person actually being good at what they're doing. And things like that are things that the British have always been known to be good at. We've always been known to be good at endurance, good at designing things, good at engineering. It's a great shame they're not able to engineer some way to prevent illegal immigrants from coming into our country, but at least they can develop new forks for cycles. And I just saw part of that on the television as you were talking then, Max. I saw those cycles with the big wide forks, and you would think that was actually going to form a bit of a windbreak there, but if you got the legs there anyway, I guess that breaks the air up and makes it flow around the knees and gives them that extra edge. So at least we have done well in some of the Olympics. I think we did. I think we did well in the girls' skateboarding as well. And there's been lots of young girls involved in the skateboarding, which quite surprised me. And I was a little bit let down, really, because on the news that day, they kept interviewing girls about skateboarding and they didn't interview one boy. And I thought, well, hang on a minute. You know, okay, girls have taken up skateboarding. That's great. They've done well against the girls. But what about the boys? Surely boys have been doing skateboarding for much longer. They're going to be probably much better at it because they're stronger. And yet they just overlook the boys. So I don't know how well they did. And I like the BMXing as well. I do like sort of tricks that they do on the BMX in the freestyle, but that's it. It's all over for another 4 years, 5 years now. I guess we can get back to normal breakfast TV and we can get back to the normal news cycle. There really hasn't been that much in the news because the government are all on holiday at the moment, but the illegal immigrants have been in the news because there's been a massive increase in their number. Hundreds of migrants who arrived in the UK after crossing the English Channel on small boats have gone missing after absconding from their hotels. As the total number of boat migrants passed 10,500 this year, 2,000 more than the 8,417 who arrived in the whole of 2020, sources said that ministers had held urgent discussions between departments over the tracking systems in place to monitor their movements after they arrive. And a further 1,500 migrants are massing around Calais and Dunkirk, waiting for an improvement in the weather. before they try to reach Britain. So we got two things here. We've got two situations. We've got a massive increase in the number of illegal immigrants that are coming over in boats that are being ferried to Britain by the RNLI, that are being taken out to the English waters by the French ships. And on top of that, when they do get here, they get put up in a 4-star hotel, maybe a 3-star hotel, certainly nothing less than that. And they don't even have the decency to stay in the hotel. They're running off. I guess that says that the 60-70 pound a week benefits that they get from the government isn't enough for them, that they're able to earn more money on the black market. And of course, this is something that Priti Patel said she was going to put a stop to within weeks, I believe, 2 years ago, and she hasn't put a stop to it. She keeps talking the talk, but she doesn't walk the walk. They sent out loads of money to France. £54 million were given to France so that they could boost surveillance of these illegal migrants that were camped there on Calais. Only it's illegal to use drones for that purpose in France. So I'm not quite sure what that money is going to be used for. And also, when they destroy these camps that the migrants build in Calais, it just encourages them to move to Britain, doesn't it? It says get in your boat and go because your tent's been knocked down by the French police. It would be so simple for them to solve this problem. All they would have to do is just take the migrants when they arrive in Britain and say, okay, we'll put you in a safe place, but it won't be in Britain. And we could take them to a safe place in Africa. There are plenty of places in Africa that could be administered by Britain. We could say that this is like a diplomatic embassy, which is supposed to be the soil of the whatever foreign embassy it is. We could say, well, this is British soil here. We have British laws here. We'll look after you here until it's safe for you to go back to your war-torn country. And that would solve the problem overnight. It did in Australia. When they did that in Australia, they said, if any more illegal immigrants set foot on Australia, we will give you asylum, but we'll give you asylum in Papua New Guinea. And they set up a camp for them in Papua New Guinea. And there weren't any more illegal immigrants that tried to come in. Of course, illegal immigration isn't the largest problem. The largest problem is legal immigration, which is much larger than illegal immigration. But illegal immigration, you don't know who it is that is coming in. And straight away, they're breaking the law. It's the equivalent of breaking into somebody's house. At least the legal migrants are taking what they've been given by our government. But those that break in illegally, they should be treated as criminals, because what they have done is criminal. And they're not being treated as criminals. They're being put up in hotels while we have veterans on the streets who are not being put up in hotels. And, you know, it just rubs everybody up the wrong way, I think, to see white homeless people on the streets and then to know that there are illegal immigrants, criminals that are lying and claiming fake asylum because there is no war in France, and they're being looked after by our government, while our government says to us, well, we're getting strict on illegal immigration and we're giving all this money to France. Well, don't give the money to France, just give the money to a country in Africa and set up a camp there and put them there, and then the migrants are happy because they're not in a war-torn country. They've been given asylum. And the British people are happy because they don't see white homeless people on the streets, and they don't see these migrants being given council houses when they need houses. I mean, it just seems so simple to me. And that's not being mean to the asylum seekers either, because that's giving them what they want. It's giving them asylum. It's just you give them it in a safe country that isn't Britain. This all seems so simple to me, Max. I'm sure it must seem simple to you, but what are your thoughts on it?
Well, my thoughts on it are that successive governments have claimed that they're going to control immigration into this country, and particularly that they're going to control and that they're going to halt illegal immigration into this country. And yet they never do. And what you have to conclude from all of this is that either they have got no intention of doing what they're saying, or they are completely incompetent. Either way, they shouldn't be in office, in my view. They shouldn't get elected. And more British people need to just wake up to that fact and stop becoming sort of fatalistic and accepting that there's nothing that could be done about illegal immigration. There is something that can be done, as you've just explained. And you're quite right that when somebody illegally immigrates into a country, then they are effectively stealing the benefits of living in that country without having contributed to those benefits. And it's interesting that the migrants don't want to go and live in a wilderness in the way that the surplus populations of Europe during the 17 and the 1800s traveled to different parts of the world. They traveled to places where there were uninhabited wildernesses, and they created civilizations in those countries. And that is something that you can we get a lot of criticism, us British, because of the British Empire and the fact that that we did that. But the point is, we weren't taking the wealth that was being that has been created by other people in the way that migrants who come to our country. And the difference is, if you migrate to a country where there already is a high technology society with a high standard of living, what you're doing is you're saying, I don't want to be part of a population of people who make their own civilization. I want to go and piggyback on somebody else's civilization. Whereas if you're a settler who goes out to an uninhabited wilderness and you build yourself a civilization there, that's something that you can take pride in, and you're making something which is your own, and you're not actually taking away from somebody else.
I'm sure there must be lots of undeveloped land over there in Africa, lots of undeveloped land, and pioneers could go there and they could start farming, they could do all sorts of things to it. But they don't seem to want that. What they do is they will look over and they'll see what we have and they think, well, we want some of that, and they're invited to come over here. This is the problem. It's not a problem that they see what we have and they want some of it. I mean, that is just perfectly natural. What is unnatural is that our government facilitates it. Our government sends out adverts to these places and says, we will help facilitate immigration. Priti Patel is making it easier for people to come into the country. When the Conservatives were voted in, everybody thought, well, great, they're going to do something about immigration. They've talked about a points-based system, and everybody looked over to Australia and said, well, look, Australia has solved the illegal immigration problem, and they've got a good points-based system, and they're only getting in the brightest people. And Priti Patel said, yeah, we're going to do a points-based system here as well. But in actual fact, if you look at what Migration Watch have to say about it, they say that the new points-based system is going to mean that there is even more immigration into this country. It's going to mean that the standards are actually lower for the people to come into the country, which is going to provide competition for the people that are already here. And it's going to lower the wages that are already here. And obviously, the increase in people means that you've got to build more houses. You're going to have less room in the schools. So, okay, they're bringing in a points-based system, but it's not going to be any good if the points aren't up very, very high. And even if the points are up very high, why aren't we making the use of the people in our own countries? If you have a points-based system which does have very high points that people have to get, and you only get the most intelligent people, then what you're actually causing is a brain drain in countries like Nigeria. And the brightest people in Nigeria who are needed to work in the hospitals there and to work in the government and do important positions, they don't want to be there because they're going to be able to earn more money in Britain. Unless they're nationalists, then they're going to want to be in their country and among their people and serve their people. But they're taught not to be nationalists, and they're said you should be capitalists and you should be going wherever you're going to make the most money, and you shouldn't be worrying about the people that you're leaving behind or the people that you're making the money from. So it's a very negative system that we've created for ourselves, and it doesn't benefit us and it doesn't benefit them, because even white countries like Bulgaria have seen a massive brain drain because we facilitated the immigration from there into Britain. They've got problems with finding enough doctors. They got problems with all these high power jobs because all the most intelligent people just flock to Northern Europe because they know that they can earn more money there. So it's no good for these other countries, and it's no good for us. And unless we get a government in that is actually going to speak up for the people that are here, it's just going to continue. And when people do speak up about it, they just get accused of being racist. And I don't think it's racist to put the position across that we are, because as I pointed out, it's not any good for those for those people or our people to have a system like this?
Yeah, I think it's quite obvious through sort of successive general elections and successive election campaigns across the country that the majority of people in Britain want illegal immigration to stop, and they want immigration into Britain from third world countries to stop. And what they don't want is somebody making it easier for people to come to this country. But the but successive governments have taken a different viewpoint. What they seem to, when they make pronouncements about illegal immigration to this country, their concern is entirely for the safety of the people who are trying to illegally break into our country. They have no concern for the impact that having all these people illegally breaking into our country is having on the living standards of the British people. And that's where successive governments have been completely at odds with the people of this country. And when they make statements, when they make pronouncements, they make it sound as though that they're going to stop or they're going to reduce illegal immigration particularly, but also legal immigration into this country from the third world. They make statements which makes it sound as if they're going to eventually reduce and stop these forms of immigration. But then, in fact, what they do is that they introduce measures which make it easier for people to immigrate into this country illegally, and they have completely chaotic immigration controls, which then means that there is a feast to be had by the lawyers who campaign on behalf of immigrants trying to get into this country, and they create wealth for the people who are trying to get people into this country. They do the opposite of what the British people want, which is to stop mass immigration from the third world and to stop illegal immigration, and that's the key thing that people have got to recognise, that they must not listen to what governments say they're going to do. They must focus on what governments actually do. And there was a very interesting article which was featured on in the Mail on Sunday about 2 weeks or so back by a male journalist who obviously is of Asian extraction, Abul Tahir, and he criticises Priti Patel, and in what I'm going to sort of share with you now, this is taken directly from Abul Tahir's article on in the Mail on Sunday, and he basically lists all the vows that Priti Patel has made and then compares it with what actually happened. And so if we look at the first one, in the Times on the 30th of August 2019, Priti Patel said after a meeting, after meeting her French counterpart, she said, "I will not let ruthless gangs of criminal people smugglers continue to put lives in danger, which is why I'm doing everything in my power to put a stop to these illegal crossings." So again, you see, her focus and her sympathy isn't on the British public having to support an increasingly large number of illegal immigrants that are coming into this country. Her sympathy lies primarily with the people who are the victims of people smugglers, and you know, quite obviously the people that are being trafficked are in cahoots with the people smugglers, aren't they? So you know, they're paying the people smugglers the money that's needed in order to get them across the channel when they're not being persecuted in France, and so you know, that they're not actually refugees or asylum seekers. They are people who are illegally gaining entry into Britain for economic gain. Abul Tahir then says, "And what has happened since Priti Patel made this?" He said that at the time, 151 migrants had arrived in boats over 6 days. So 151 over 6 days, and in total, 1,835 had landed in the UK on cross-channel boats in 2019, according to the think tank Migration Watch. Well, this year so far, we've had 10,500 migrants come across the channel, and we're getting them coming across over the last sort of few weeks at the rate of 400 to 500 a day, not 151 migrants over 6 days, and say that the situation has got immeasurably worse. And Abdul Tahir then goes through a whole list of vows that Priti Patel made. So he details on the 1st of January in the Daily Telegraph, it was reported in 2020, her vow was to follow the example of Australia, which drastically reduced the number of illegal entries, saying that anyone smuggled by gangs would be sent straight back where they travelled from. Well, I don't think the numbers that have been sent back where they travelled from are very large. And certainly from the statistics I've seen, they are very few and far between. The Home Office has failed to send migrants back to France or Europe. For instance, of the nearly 9,000 who crossed the channel so far this year, not one has been returned to France. Priti Patel seeks a new, there was a title, a headline that Priti Patel seeks a new agreement with the European Union, blah, 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 blah. And her vow, as reported by Abdul Tahir, was that she had met France's interior minister to renegotiate the Dublin Agreement, which stipulates that asylum seekers must apply for asylum in the European country they first entered. Post-Brexit Britain isn't part of this agreement, so Ms. Patel now needs to make separate arrangements with individual EU countries to ensure that those arriving here must claim asylum in France or in countries on the European mainland where they first arrived. What's happened since? No new deals have been struck, which is why no asylum seeker from France was deported this year. And this list goes on and on and on. And I would suggest to anybody who's kind of interested in this, who still believes that the current Conservative government has got any intention of bringing immigration under control, that people read that particular article, because it is damning of the current government and severely critical of Priti Patel. And it makes anybody reading that, anybody with an intelligence reading that, must then draw the conclusion that the government have got no intention of reducing mass immigration or of actually stopping illegal immigrants, certainly not stopping illegal immigrants from the point of view of protecting the interests of the British people, although they may want to formalise and make more routine and regular the cross-channel boating that's being done in order to protect the lives of the people that are trying to break into our country.
Well, I guess they would say, well, at least we're not Labour, and Diane Abbott wanted to fly them in, didn't she? She wanted to get rid of all the borders, and we'll set up routes so that anybody that wants to come into the country can come into the country. And that's the alternative that we're offered. We've got either the Conservatives or the Labour, but both of them are just going to allow the country to be open, and they would just allow people to break into the country, and they won't do anything about it. They're saying now that they're going to increase the punishments for the people smugglers, and she's been saying this all along, and she's been saying that she's going to send them back to the country that they've come from, the people that have tried to break in, and she hasn't done that. And I think when she says, you know, when she puts their needs first and says, well, it's a dangerous crossing and all the rest of it, we should be doing the same. I think we should make our propaganda the same, because, you know, we should look at things objectively and say, well, what is good for us is most likely going to be good for these other people as well. If we can prevent them from coming over here, it solves the problem for us, and also it means that they're not taking that dangerous crossing. And the way to get them to stop taking that dangerous crossing is to say, well, if you do come here, you're going to be put in another country. Or another way to do it would be to say, if you do come here and you try to break into our country, then we're going to turn your boat around. We're going to fire shots in the air until you turn your boat around, because it is better that one or two of you drown rather than thousands of you try to break into the country and hundreds of you drown. You know, to make an omelette, you've got to crack a few eggs. And this is the argument that people have made before. They've said, you know, well, the army should be defending us. They should be defending us from these people that are trying to break in the same way that a homeowner might defend his house. I mean, I'm not quite sure what the British laws are on that. But in America, you know, if somebody tries to break into your house, you can shoot them. So if somebody's trying to break into your country, you should be able to fire on them. And if they were to do that, okay, say you fired on a vessel you would then have to go and pick the people up because you'd hold the vessel or whatever. You'd then have to go and rescue them. But the message then would be sent to the rest of them not to attempt that, not to try and break into that country. That is not a viable route. And that would prevent them from coming in. And once again, that would save them from taking the risks of going out in those rickety little boats in the middle of the shipping lanes and running the risk of drowning. I mean, we can make the same arguments that they do, and I think we should make the same arguments that they do, and at the same time make out the problems that we face, because I think that's what's going to appeal to people, because their arguments appeal to people, and you get, you know, the left-wing people saying, oh, well, we're so worried about these migrants in the shipping lanes. Well, yeah, okay, we're worried about them as well. We don't want them to drown in the shipping lanes either, but we have a better solution. We have a solution which will actually put a stop to it, rather than a solution that doesn't put a stop to it, and we have to keep thinking up another one every 6 months because it keeps increasing. All right, well, should we get into our Greatest Britain's then, Max? We finished with the immigration conversation for today?
I think we have, yes. Let's move on.
Yeah, let's get into talking about Carl Pearson, a particular favourite of yours. We're going to be talking about a scientific Greatest Britain today. Do you want to just tell us in particular why you think Carl Pearson should be one of our Greatest Britons, Max?
Well, Carl Pearson is a polymath. That is somebody who has achieved a high level of study and competence in a range of different subjects. He's not just become a specialist in one particular field. He's known best as being a mathematician and a biostatistician. But he was a protege of Sir Francis Galton that we've covered before in the Greatest Britons. And he's just an outstanding scholar, an outstanding scientist. He's studied maths at Cambridge. He studied physics at Heidelberg University. He studied metaphysics, physiology, Roman law, 16th century German literature, English law, and socialism, which is one of the things that first caught my eye. Carl Pearson came to know of Carl Pearson through a pamphlet that had been written at the time, which basically was the text of a speech that he'd made back in 1900. This was a speech he'd made to, I think, somewhere in Newcastle. I'm not quite sure what the venue was, but this speech was entitled "National Life from the Standpoint of Science," because Carl Pearson was a racialist. He believed in the importance of race, and that he felt that race is an important factor in all of human affairs. He was also a eugenicist. And he was a scientific nationalist, and so he believed in applying the findings of science to making the nation stronger. And at the same time, he was a socialist. And if you read another speech that he made, which is called Socialism in Theory and Practice, it could have almost been written by Robert Blatchford that we've just finished covering, because it was the issues that Carl Pearson raises are exactly the same issues that Robert Blatchford raises in his writings in Merry England and Britain for the British. And so Carl Pearson, in combining nationalism and socialism in what he called scientific nationalism, he was back in the late 1800s, because he wrote some of these, he started writing about these things in about 1884, I think it was, and so he was a homegrown National Socialist that predates anything that occurred on the continent of Europe 50 years or so later.
So he was a genius, somebody that we can all look up to, basically, that set standards and broke records and discovered new things and basically laid the foundations for a lot of the science that gets discussed today. Well, Carl Pearson was born on the 27th of March, 1857, and he died the 27th of April 1936, and he was an English mathematician and a biostatistician. And biostatistics is the development and application of statistical methods to a wide range of topics in biology. It encompasses the design of biological experiments, the collection and analysis of data from those experiments, and the interpretation of the results. And I would guess that, that's where his understanding of race came from, because if this was the first time that you were collecting measurements of people, measuring their bone structure, their proportions, and then collating it all together and looking at groups rather than looking at individuals, this was the first time that it was possible to be done, and he was the first person to do this, to think of biostatistics, to take all these statistics of biological measurements and then have a look at them and see what the averages are and see what the differences are between people. So he was a father of biostatistics. You know much about biostatistics, Max?
I would say not an incredible amount. I mean, in this respect, Carl Pearson was continuing the work of Sir Francis Galton, and so some of the things that Carl Pearson worked on were inspired by Sir Francis Galton. Some of the things that Carl Pearson looked into, it was using statistics in order to determine whether there is a valid conclusion that can be drawn from that body of statistics, basically. And what I would say is that virtually anybody who's been to university and who studied a science at university will, for their dissertation, have needed to create a statistical analysis to determine whether or not the outcome that they identified in their dissertation was statistically valid, and the mathematics that they would have used in order to do that would have been developed by Sir Francis Galton and by Carl Pearson subsequently. And so, people who go to university nowadays and who become very woke as a result of that may shrink back in horror at the thought that they're actually using techniques developed by somebody like Carl Pearson, but in fact they are. And so that's something for them to contemplate. There are some interesting things that Carl Pearson did. One of the things that stuck in my mind from when I first started reading about him was the fact that he measured the heights of people in prison. And he didn't just do this so that he could determine how tall the average criminal is. He measured the heights of criminals over a period of decades and established the rate at which people's height diminishes as they get older. And this can then be used in various lines of endeavour that are intended to bring relief to people who are perhaps suffering in old age and that sort of thing. But one of the things that he determined was that the average person from their prime at the age of 30 will lose an inch in height by the time they reach age 60. And then on average, they will then lose a further inch in height for every decade they live beyond age 60, which I think is quite an interesting thing. And that's why, there's the origin of the phrase, the little old lady and the little old man that people talk about. This little old lady came down the street, this little old man came down the street, or whatever. And it is a provable fact that people get a bit smaller as they get older. And that's why you do tend to see lots of old ladies and old men who are on average shorter than the youthful population. That's just because they have shrunk slightly as time's gone by.
So he proved that that wasn't just something that you saw, that was something that could be measured, and that was something that was universal. So I guess he was in the business of dispelling superstition. And if you can collect statistics like that, from the conclusions that you reach, you can make predictions as well. So it would have been very useful. Well, he has been credited with establishing the discipline of mathematical statistics, which is the application of probability theory. So that there we have it. If something is likely to happen, you can work that out from the statistics, whether or not something is going to happen. The probability of it occurring comes from these statistics. He founded the world's first university statistics department at University College London in 1911 and contributed significantly to the field of biometrics and meteorology. So again, he was interested in the weather, the same as Francis Galton. Pearson was also a proponent of social Darwinism. eugenics, and Wikipedia tells us scientific racism. And I thought I'd look up their description of scientific racism, because I've got a few points I'd like to make on this. And they say scientific racism, sometimes termed biological racism, is the pseudo-scientific belief that empirical evidence exists to support or justify racism, which means racial discrimination, racial inferiority, or racial superiority. Historically, scientific racism received credence throughout the scientific community, but it is no longer considered scientific. And I answer that by saying, well, racism isn't scientific, but differences between the races are certainly proved by science. Dividing humankind into biologically distinct groups is sometimes called racialism, race realism, or race science by its proponents. Modern scientific consensus rejects this view as being irreconcilable with modern genetic research. And that's what Wikipedia says there. They say that the scientific consensus rejects this view. Well, no, the scientific consensus rejects racism, but not the fact that the races are different. We can see observably they are different. The statistics show that they are different. And what they're doing is they're being very disingenuous here. They're trying to discredit all the research he did by calling it racism. He may have been racist, but the research that he did, if it hasn't been proved to be false, then it was true. The mainstream media basically tries to claim that this research is irreconcilable with modern genetic research, but the only really way you could prove these scientists wrong in their results would be to find a different result, yet the results are consistent across the board. There are differences between the races. Whether you use those facts to support racism or not is the point. And perhaps these early scientists did, because that was the time they lived in, but that does not negate their statistics. And their statistics is what Wikipedia is trying to pretend here have been discredited, because the people that discovered the statistics were racist. Well, facts can't be racist. Only the people using them can be. And that depends entirely on what they are using the facts for. So this scientific racism, saying he's a proponent of scientific racism, that's just an attempt to smear him. I mean, what they should really have said is that he was a proponent of biostatistics, and he measured the differences between the races, and he showed that there were differences between them. But then, unfortunately, he decided to go into some races are superior to other races. And, you know, as I've spoken about before, what is the benchmark that you are going to have for that? You know, it's like saying humpback whales are superior to blue whales. Well, they're not. They're a completely different kettle of fish. So when you're talking about races, races are different to one another. You cannot say that one is superior to another, because you have no benchmark for it, because the only benchmark you have is your own race. So it's an impossible question to answer. And that's what racism is. It's an impossible question to answer. That's not what we deal with here, and that's not really what these scientists were dealing with. They discovered facts. It's the way that you use the facts that determines whether somebody is being racist or not. So Wikipedia is just trying to smear all of this and saying that it's scientific racism. And you know, I think I've just shown that what the facts aren't the scientific racism. It's just the way that they use that is important here. What yes. do you think of that, Max?
Yes, I would agree with what you're saying there. In terms of superiority or not, I think that you can say that one particular race on average is superior at a particular task, but then another race on average might be superior at a different task. And if one racial group has a culture which does not value scientific endeavor, for example, then they will not develop their scientific knowledge, and so therefore their scientific knowledge will be inferior to a race that does value scientific knowledge and scientific endeavor. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the race that didn't develop that didn't engage in scientific endeavor is inferior to the race that did. It just means that they have got no interest in it.
Yeah, that's the benchmark. That's when you actually come up with a benchmark, then you can do these measurements. But you cannot just say one race is inferior and another race is superior. And that was that. You know, that is the allegation that they are making here is that that's what these people did. Maybe that is what they did. That was the time that they lived in. But it doesn't disprove all those measurements that they did and all those statistics that they collated. Well, Pearson was also a protege and a biographer of Sir Francis Galton. He edited and completed both William Kingdon Clifford's Common Sense of the Exact Sciences in 1885 and Isaac Toadhunter's History of the Theory of Elasticity, Volume 1, 1886 to 1893, and Volume 2, 1893, following their deaths. Now, they brought this up, so they're obviously quite important books, but I haven't heard of them before. Have you heard of these books before, Max?
No, I haven't heard of those before, no. I'm not sure what they contain. I have read some of Carl Pearson's work, but I wouldn't say that I've read even the majority of it, to be quite honest, because he wrote so many papers on so many subjects and so many books that it would take a lot of time to read everything that he's written.
Yeah, the actual number, I mean, I couldn't count them. Countless books and articles and speeches that this man has given, and all of them scientific. Well, let's have a look at his early life here. He was born in Islington, London, into a Quaker family. So I suspect there was a lot of time that was spent in silence and studying, because the Quakers are known for silence, aren't they? I think when they have their meetings, they just sit there in silence until somebody thinks of something important to say. Do you know much about Quakers, Max?
No, other than that Quakers were they were called Quakers because they literally were believed to quake in the presence of the Lord, and they sometimes used to have bizarre names like Joseph shaking in the presence of the Lord and things of that sort, which was a quaint aspect of their lives. But generally speaking, what I know of Quakers is that they have tended to work hard. The Quaker families that have tended to do well are families like the Cadburys, who tended to have a very sympathetic understanding of the needs of the people who worked for them, and who tried to uplift the people who worked for them. And as I've mentioned, I think last week, with regard to Cadburys, they created the Bourneville Village, which was an idyllic village that was intended to provide the kind of the ideal environment for people, and so they did have a great deal of care for the people in their charge. They were persecuted at some point during history, and a large number of them then went over to what is now the United States of America, and I believe there probably are more Quakers in the United States of America than there are in Britain today. But I've not really studied them in any great depth, to be quite honest.
Yeah, I know they have a very, very strong work ethic, and I think their meetings are held in silence. And it's interesting because Pearson was actually an atheist. So he was brought up in this Quaker family, but he ended up being an atheist. His father was William Pearson QC, of the Inner Temple, and his mother was Fanny Nee Smith, and he had two siblings, Arthur and Amy. So his father was a QC, so high up in the law trade. So that intelligence, that very high IQ, has been passed down to his children. Pearson has basically inherited his intelligence from his father here. That's what that says to me. Pearson attended University College School, followed by King's College, Cambridge, in 1876 to study mathematics, graduating in 1879 as third wrangler in the mathematical tripos, which meant that he got first-class honours in his final year. That's what a third wrangler is. He then travelled to Germany, studying physics at the University of Heidelberg under G.H. Quink and metaphysics under Kuno Fischer. After that, he visited the University of Berlin, where he attended the lectures of the physiologist Emil Dubois-Raymond on Darwinism, and Emil was a brother of Paul Dubois-Raymond, the mathematician. Again, so you see, it runs in the family. Intelligence runs in the family. Pearson also studied Roman law, medieval and 16th century German literature, and socialism. He became an accomplished historian and Germanist, and spent much of the 1880s in Berlin, Heidelberg, and Vienna. He wrote on passion plays, religion, Goethe and Werther, as well as sex-related themes, and was a founder of the Men and Women's Club, which was a debating society for men and women to discuss relations between the sexes. I bet that was interesting. I'd like to see some of the transcripts from that, the way that men and women used to interact before the age of feminism. And I should imagine his work on passion plays and religion would have been quite critical, because he was an atheist. You got any comments you want to make on any of that, Max?
Well, the fact that there was a men and women's club which debated issues that related to the sort of interrelations of the sexes, I think that rather throws a spanner in the works as far as feminists are concerned, militant feminists nowadays, who claim that men, I can remember I was listening to an episode of Woman's Hour on the radio as I was driving along a few days back, and this woman was saying there that men in times gone by, when men dominated the publishing trade and the arts and things like this, that men didn't consider women or women's needs whatsoever. Well, the fact that there was a men and women's club, which was a debating society for men and women, where women could debate with men, actually proves that wrong, doesn't it?
Well, it does, and that was 140 years ago as well, so I don't see much oppression of women going on there. He was offered a Germanics post at King's College, Cambridge, and when comparing Cambridge students to those he knew from Germany, Karl found German students inathletic and weak. He wrote to his mother, "I used to think athletics and sport were overestimated at Cambridge, but now I think it cannot be too highly valued." And I find this interesting because when Adolf Hitler took power with the National Socialists, a big part of National Socialism was getting the youth to get involved in sport and to be athletic. And this was 60 years before then, 50 or 60 years before then. So perhaps there was a problem with the Germans. Perhaps they really didn't do very much athletics at school. And, you know, because he was obviously a fan of the Germans, he was a fan of Germanism, but he actually found that they're physically, they were rather a weak race, which surprises me. Well, in his first book, The New Werther, Pearson gives us a clear indication of why he studied so many diverse subjects. He said, "I rush from science to philosophy, and from philosophy to our old friends, the poets. And then, overwearied by too much idealism, I fancy I become practical in returning to science. Have you ever attempted to conceive all there is in the world worth knowing, that not one subject in the universe is unworthy of study? The giants of literature, the mysteries of many-dimensional space, the attempts of Boltzmann and Crookes to penetrate nature's very laboratory, the Kantian theory of the universe, and the latest discoveries in embryology, with their wonderful tales of the development of life. What an immensity beyond our grasp. Mankind seems on the verge of a new and glorious discovery. What Newton did to simplify the planetary motions must now be done to unite in one whole the various isolated theories of mathematical physics." So there's a lot there, and he's basically saying he had this zest for learning, to find out everything that he possibly could about everything, and that there is nothing in the universe that is unworthy of study. And, you know, I would like to aspire to that. I like to learn about as many different things as possible. And I guess he was also, even though he was educated at these universities, he was also somewhat of an autodidact, and just studying whatever it was that he could study and find out everything that he could about it, with the aim of using these different disciplines to come to blend them together into some kind of whole, some kind of uniting theory. So if he was studying one thing, like he says here, studying philosophy, then he could use the information that he had learned about religion in philosophy, or the information that he'd learned in biology, he could use that in religion. So it's good to learn about as many different things as possible. And today, people just tend to concentrate on one thing. They will just study one thing, and to the exclusion of everything else. Whereas I think back then, you were given a much more rounded education, and you could learn about all these different things, because there wasn't so much information there in these disciplines that there is now. You got so much information in one small part of medicine today, that you need to just study that one part of it to learn all there is to do with it. But back then, when there wasn't that much information about, when we didn't have the internet, you would study the classics, you would study classic civilization and get up to speed on everything that had got us up to that point today. And then you could look into everything, because there wasn't that much information there. Today, we've got information overload. But I still think it's the best way to be is to study everything you can and try to find out everything that you can about everything. Well, what do you think of his indication here for why he studied so many diverse subjects, Max?
Yeah, I agree with what you were saying, actually. And I think that one of the things that happened in the past, because we didn't have computers and the internet, was that people, if they wanted to become a polymath in the way that Carl Pearson did, then they would need to rely solely upon their brain power to actually remember all the things and to hold all the various theories and notions, etc., that they had in their head. And from an evolutionary perspective, we've created books. Books then meant that people didn't have to carry everything in their head. They could carry a book around and refer to the book instead of remembering the information. And now we've got the internet, people don't have to carry books around. They can just Google something on the internet. It's quite right what you say, that with certain scientific subjects now, they're far more detailed, that there's a lot more for people to actually know. But I agree with you that it is still a good discipline to try and learn as much as you can, because that proves your worth, because as a human, because in comparison with somebody who relies on the internet, if there's a power cut or the internet goes down for any reason, then that person no longer has access to all the information that's held on the internet. If there is some kind of apocalyptic event that happens in the future, and both the internet and the vast libraries that currently exist are destroyed, then again, those people who've been able to hold a lot of information in their heads, people who've become polymaths, will be exceedingly valuable people. The old saying, in the land of the blind, a one-eyed man is king, and the same would be true in a post-apocalyptic world where libraries and the internet have gone down.
Well, the other thing is, I mean, if you've studied one discipline, you can apply the knowledge that you got in that discipline to another discipline, and you can look at it from a different point of view. And I should imagine that they would also study mnemonics before they had books, and even when they did have books. I mean, at this time, they would learn stuff by memory so that they could repeat speeches from memory and things like that, and learn different mnemonic tricks so that you could remember long lengths of text and repeat them. And of course, all of that is just forgotten today. I can remember at school learning to do plays and learning my lines and thinking how difficult it was to do that. And yet people would remember whole poems off by heart years ago. They would challenge the mind all the time. And they probably didn't have so many problems with dementia as we do now.
Yes.
They say that, don't they? The more crosswords you do, the less likely you are to get dementia, because you're challenging the mind. And, we concentrate,
that's right.
We concentrate so much on physical, being strong physically and working in the gym, and yet people aren't challenging the mind anymore because they just Google everything.
That's right. Widely believed now in medicine that if you in older age decide to learn a new language, or decide to learn how to play a musical instrument, or take up a new skill and learn to become proficient in a new skill, some form of handicraft or whatever, metalworking, woodworking, basketry or embroidery, all these kind of things, they stimulate the brain and seem to stave off Alzheimer's and dementia and things of that sort.
I think it's because the brain is quite plastic, isn't it? And when you're learning new things, it develops in new ways. So you go through one discipline and your brain is shaped one way, and then you start learning another discipline and your brain gets shaped another way. And it's because your brain is plastic, and it sort of grows with the memories, with the new memories. So it's constantly keeping it active, basically, so that it doesn't go to sleep. Well, his next move was to return to London to study law, emulating his father, and quoting from his own account, he said, "Coming to London, I read in chambers in Lincoln's Inn, drew up bills of sale, and was called to the bar, but varied legal studies by lecturing on Heat at Barnes, on Martin Luther at Hampstead, and on Lassalle and Marx on Sundays at revolutionary clubs around Soho." So he got very interested in learning all about the legal side of things, and this is after doing the scientific stuff. And his next career move was to the Inner Temple, the same as his father, where he read law until 1881, although he never practiced it. After this, he returned to mathematics, deputising for the mathematics professor at King's College London in 1881 and for the professor at University College London in 1883. In 1884, he was appointed to the Goldschmidt Chair of Applied Mathematics and Mechanics at University College London. Pearson became the editor of Common Sense of the Exact Sciences in 1885 when William Kingdon Clifford died. And in 1890, he married Maria Sharp. The couple had three children, Sigrid Letitia Pearson, Helga Sharp Pearson, and Egon Pearson, who became a statistician himself and succeeded his father as head of the Applied Statistics Department at University College. So we see there the intelligence passes down from the grandfather to the father to the son. It's hereditary. IQ is hereditary. Intelligence is hereditary. Do you want to add anything to that, Max?
No. I think you've explained that pretty well. That were the sort of comments I would have made, that intelligence, I believe, is hereditary.
And interesting that his daughters didn't appear to follow him into anything. They appear to have become loyal wives, housewives, but his son became a statistician and succeeded his father as the head of the...
One of Pearson's beliefs that he sort of wrote about in National Life from the Standpoint of Science, or which he spoke, because that was a speech, was that it was a duty for middle-class people to have children so that they could increase the average intelligence of their nation. And he points to the fact that during the period that he was alive and prior to that, and also subsequent to that, the opposite has been happening, where middle-class people have tended to have fewer children and have limited their family size in order that they can send their children to the best schools, etc. Whereas Pearson's, the point that Pearson made quite strongly was that it would be better to have had more children and for those children to have had a lower position in society initially than for those children never to have existed at all.
That would have been better for society, wouldn't it? But of course, that's getting rather close to eugenics, which we will be discussing next week. I think we should leave that there for now, Max. So thank you very much. Thank you very much for coming on today.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.